Hello, everybody. Today we have the pleasure to have with us Dr. Alice Bertaina from the Division of Hematology, Oncology, Stem Cell Transplantation and Regenerative Medicine, Department of Pediatrics, Stanford University, California, USA. Hello, Alice. How are you? It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Hi, Carmelo, and hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me. This is really exciting and I'm delighted to be here.
We are very appreciative you accepted our invitation. And today we are going to talk about your recent New England Journal of Medicine article. So let's start with a little bit of background. Can you elaborate on the Schimke immunoosseous dysplasia? And can you tell us some characteristics of the syndromes, some features?
Yes, sure. Well, first of all, Schimke immunoosseous dysplasia, SIOD, just for brevity while we talk, is a very rare genetic disorder. It's a very rare genetic disorder that it can be most often fatal by the age of 9 in patients who have the more severe phenotype of the disease. It is due to a biallelic mutations in the gene encoding SMARCA1. Which really translates in defect in many, many organs. The main two organs that are affected are the bone marrow and the kidneys, but not only. I mentioned these two characteristics because are really crucial for the work that we have done. These patients have a T-cell immunodeficiency, which is mostly about the naive compartment. It has been studied and, you know, it has been debated for years if this naive defect is related to the immune deficiency itself or mostly to a problem of thymic stroma. And I think that our data in terms of immune reconstitution post-transplant show that with a healthy donor immune system, we have a normal development of the naive compartment. But just to say that is a very debated point. And they have this glucocorticoid resistant nephropathic syndrome, which eventually progress to focal segmental glomerulosclerosis and therefore end stage kidney disease. Beside that, these patients also have a DNA repair defect, which makes them much more sensitive to a genotoxic agent, along with their really problem in telomere maintenance. So you can understand that for their life, these patients are affected already by short stature, a spondyloepiphyseal dysplasia, along with very often problems in their thyroid. And of course, these FSGS and T-cell immune deficiency, which bring them to be dependent from the dialysis and eventually candidate to a kidney transplant. Their main cause of death is though related to the T-cell deficiency and the evolution in bone marrow failure syndrome. Infections are reported amongst the main cause of death in these patients. Although patients who live longer mostly die due to strokes and aneurysmatic lesions that are really related to their collagen defect in the endothelium and that are very difficult to control in these patients with regular supportive therapy.
So we understand that these are like very rare, but also very complicated cases that you have been studying on. So, and I understand it's clear the rationale, of course, for the kidney and bone marrow transplantation because of the particular features these little patients have. Can I ask you, going a little bit more in details on the bone marrow transplant, which type of platform did you choose?
Yes, absolutely. And that gives me, you know, the possibility of explaining a little bit more about the experience with stem cell transplantation in SIOD patients, because these patients represented the challenge from many perspectives. represented the challenge. They required a stem cell transplantation and a kidney transplantation. So in one hand, they represented the ideal population to test our hypothesis, but they also had criticism related, for example, to their DNA repair defect. We couldn't use in these patients a myeloablative conditioning regimen. And in fact, if we look into the literature, there are only 5 patients with SIOD reported to receive a bone marrow transplantation, which in that case was myeloablative. And there is just one of the patients who is a long-term survivor. The other 4 died because of transplant-related complications, which were mostly graft-versus-host disease, infection, and toxicity overall related to the conditioning regimen. So the first question was really, how can we design a reduced toxicity conditioning regimen that can have these patients engrafting, but not being too toxic, and how we can avoid severe graft-versus-host disease, which can be deleterious in these patients who are so fragile. And so that's why we decided to use the platform of the alpha-beta T-cell depletion, which we have established in a really large number of patients with different non-malignant disorders, including Fanconi anemia patients, for example, or other telomeropathies, that gave us a good basis to believe that that approach was tolerable by this category of patients. And the other challenge that these patients represented is that they were on end-stage renal disease. 2 of them were on dialysis. 1 of them was a CKD stage 3. So the conditioning regimen was designed, first of all, to be a reduced toxicity. And I really translated the experience that we had with the Fanconi anemia patients because it was the closest population in terms of specificity. But then we needed really to consider the renal insufficiency. And therefore, the real-time evaluation of fludarabine PK was incredibly helpful. And is something that really impacted a lot in the outcome of these patients, both in the patient in dialysis and in that patient who was not in dialysis yet. We were able to modulate the dose, and actually we ended up in giving much less fludarabine than we were supposed to, just based on the body weight and even in the estimated clearance. So it's something which we need really to consider now that it's available for this category of patients. I think that the strategy of overall using the alpha-beta cell depletion was successful because none of these patients developed significant graft-versus-host disease. Actually, just 1 of them developed a transient grade 2 skin only GVHD, which was treated with very low dose of steroids. And on the other hand, the immune reconstitution was great. In fact, all these patients went to a kidney transplantation already having a basically a normal T cell function, which allow us to, you know, do not have viral complication after the kidney transplantation, which is one of the main problems in this group of patients.
Thank you. That's very interesting. So you had like basically you design a very tailored conditioning regimen that was also adjusted according to the individual patient pharmacokinetics. So what was the conditioning regimen based on? You said fludarabine and?
So it was low dose of fludarabine and cyclophosphamide, mm-hmm. and then had 200 centigrade of total body irradiation, mm-hmm. and then the backbone of immune modulation with ATG and rituximab.
Okay, and how about engraftment and chimerism data instead?
Yes, so the engraftment was really rapid and fast in all 3 patients, without really any difference in comparison with the other non-malignant patients that we have treated overall with this platform. We have neutrophil engraftment as average by day 12 and then platelet engraftment by day 15. Chimerism, we have full donor chimerism since the engraftment for patients 1 and patient 3. And the chimerism didn't, modify between the actual engraftment and the last follow-up, which is now over 34 months post kidney transplantation, so longer for post stem cell transplantation. For patient number two, who is the patient, interestingly, where the cellularity of the bone marrow was a little higher, about 40%, while in the other two was already below 10%. We had an initial mixed chimerism that anyway was always above 80% of donor cells and became a full donor by day 150 post-stem cell transplantation. All of these happen without pharmacological immune suppression, like is typical of the alpha beta T cell depletion. So it was a very, I would say, very standard recovery in terms of hematopoietic and lymphoid engraftment in these patients.
I see. So basically, what we can infer is that, like, perhaps this little hump of patient number two was just because he or she, I don't remember like the gender of this little patient, she had like still some like good cellularity, and therefore like perhaps the reduced intensity might have like caused a little bit of delayed full chimerism.
The other hypothesis is related to the SMARCA1 mutation. We do not have data enough on that. We need to, you know, because there are not so many SLD patients transplanted. But again, interestingly, the father of this patient, who was the stem cell donor, had an hypomorphic mutation of SMARCA1, which was a little different from the other two, the one of the mother and the one of the father of the other family. And so a possibility is also that really the donor cells were less able to right away overcome the presence of anyway just a partial immune deficiency. That's an important point, you know, especially in the perspective of broadening this approach to other diseases. It is true that these patients have a T cell immune deficiency, but they are not comparable to severe immune deficiency. All of them had antibodies, for example, before the stem cell transplantation, and had some level of response to vaccination, as well as, you know, T cell function evaluated by PHA. So it's a really a partial immune deficiency, which means that still we have to overcome some potential risk of rejection.
Right. So turning now to the kidney transplantation part, when was that performed? Did the patient receive any periprocedural immunosuppressive treatment?
So the kidney transplantation was performed between 5 and 10 months post-stem cell transplantation. We do not know what is the sweet spot for that. And I would say that really the timing of the kidney transplantation has been mostly dictated by the nutritional status of these patients. My colleagues on the renal team really felt very strong about waiting for the surgery until the patient was really able to have an adequate caloric intake to do not compromise the healing of the process. And then for patients two, we were in the middle of the pandemic. And so we postponed the kidney transplantation that was planned also for about 5 months post-transplant, because it was the beginning. And, you know, we didn't feel, mostly for the donor, to put him at risk of getting the infection. Is that the ideal timing? I'm not sure. I mean, from an immunological perspective, I would almost say that doing that earlier might make more sense. But again, we have to face the reality that for these specific patients are patients who are in enteral nutrition and they have another layer of complexity. So it's not just the immunological balance. In terms of immunosuppression, so of course we were terrified by the idea that those patients could develop either rejection or graft versus host disease after the kidney transplantation. And despite the fact that they were 100% chimeric on the CD3 subset, we decided to really be extremely cautious and utilize a peri transplantation immune prophylaxis, which was done with a very low dose of steroids and with tacrolimus that we targeted between 5 and 8, so a lower level than we usually do. For patients number 1 and number 3, for patients number 1 and number 2, we stopped the immunosuppression by day 30. It was exactly day 30 for the first patient, and you can imagine that we were much more nervous for him. For patient 2, I think it was 27 or around. For patient number 3, actually, we had a surprise because she developed a severe hyperglycemia after starting the steroids and the tacro. And basically, we had to stop the steroids on day 5 and the tacro on day 12. And everything went really smoothly. So again, I think that this peritransplant immune suppression is mostly for control our anxiety and not for really controlling a risk on the patients. But as long as 1 month, I don't think it compromises anything and makes, especially me and Dr. Grimm sleep a little bit more hours.
Yeah, and I can definitely understand and I feel you when you express a little bit of anxiety when we talk about this very unknown fields, because it's really like very experimental at this point, since very few data in the literature, if nothing, are present. So how about instead the journey of these little patients after a transplant? We mentioned like about the actual kidney transplant, but did they experience any adverse event, GVHD, for instance, or infections along the way?
They really did very uneventfully, and much better than we thought. Graft versus host disease wise, patient number 1 developed this grade 2 skin-only GVHD, which was controlled with less than 1 mg/kg of steroids and completely resolved just with that treatment. Patients number 2 and number 3 didn't develop any acute GVHD, nor anybody developed chronic graft versus host disease. And now we have a follow-up, which is about 14 months after the stem cell transplant for the first patient, and about 26 for the third. So that's the range. Viral infection, we had just a transient HHV6 viremia that we treated with valganciclovir, but nothing that required admission for the treatment or who impacted the counts. They didn't have CMV reactivation. Remarkably, they didn't have BK viremia after the kidney transplantation, which is again a very important point because this is something that usually bothers the post-transplant course of a kidney transplantation. So I don't have so much toxicity to report.
We are totally happy.
Which is great. I think that the main challenge is going to be, from my perspective, is that how much the transplant is going to impact on the rest of the complication. For example, I'm very, really curious to understand if an early stem cell transplantation can impact the endothelium and therefore can reduce the risk of the vascular complication, which are so dramatic for these patients. These 3 SIOD kids didn't have major problems before the transplant. We have screened them all with an MRI, MRA, exactly to make sure that from an angiogram perspective, there were no big abnormalities that we need to be aware of. And so far, they didn't have any event, but of course, we will see on the long term. But I think that from an SIOD perspective, really understanding if this an early stem cell transplantation can impact on the other organs affected by this SMARCA1 mutation, it's a big question.
And do you have any data on the immune reconstitution instead following the bone marrow transplantation? We already discussed about the infection. So I gather if potentially they didn't have like so many infection. This is because probably also the immune reconstitution worked like along the way, and the T cell probably became functional and active very soon thereafter. Perhaps this might also explain why they didn't have the common complication we are used to see in both this type of transplants. Do you have any data on this?
Yes, sure. So first of all, the first two patients also received an add-back of donor-derived lymphocyte, which were genetically modified with a suicide gene for the inducible cascade 9. The reason being that really when we started this project, the clinical trial with the add-back of these T cells was still ongoing, and so we had the possibility of having this the cells manufactured and to have a single patient IND for them. And my reasoning, behind using these cells was exactly trying to give them some more mature T cells post-transplant that could mitigate the risk of infection. For patient number three, these cells manufacturing was not available anymore, so she didn't receive. And I would say that between these three, across the three patients, the immune reconstitution was pretty much superimposable. So the patients who received the RIBO cells, the IC9 modified cells, didn't necessarily had a much more expedited immune reconstitution. I think that the most important highlight to tell you about the immune reconstitution was the actually emergence of naive T cells, which happened about 3 months post-stem cell transplant, although they had significant absolute numbers at 6 months post-transplantation. To me, again, from an SID perspective, it means that their thymus works. They just need healthy T cells that can, an healthy stem cell actually, that can mature. All of them had a normal T cell function measured by responsiveness to PHA before the kidney transplantation. So that's again, it is between 5 and 10 months post stem cell transplantation, which is pretty consistent. If I think about our overall cohort of alpha beta transplanted patients, about 50% of them achieve a normal T cell function by 6 months post transplant. Of course, these patients were chemo naive before they approach, so they could have had an advantage in terms of T cell immune reconstitution than a leukemia patient, for example. But yes, I would say that those are the main highlight in terms of immune reconstitution.
Thank you. That's like really fascinating, knowing that these three kids had very limited, if basically nothing, of immunosuppression, and particularly when thinking about complication, short and long term effect inherent to these drugs. Do you think this strategy can be applied also in other settings? And if so, where do you envision this strategy to be successful?
Thank you for this question, because this is really the core, of all this work. As I said at the beginning, SIUD and these patients represented the ideal proof of concept that this approach can work in terms of tandem approach, in terms of tailoring a conditioning regimen on a patient in chronic kidney failure, and so on. So yes, I believe that this approach can work in other indications. And actually, while the paper was getting out on May 27, the FDA approved a new clinical trial that we are going to start very soon. And in this clinical trial, we are going to test our hypothesis in other renal diseases, which will be, in this case, cystinosis and autoimmune-mediated focal segmental glomerulosclerosis and lupus, erythematosus systemic with class 4 and 5 nephritis. we need to start from some indications and then expand like we did for SIOD. The challenge that we are going to have is, of course, the commissioning arrangement that cannot be the same that we use for SIOD. But I would say, that we actually have designed a different conditioning regimen and that we have treated already two patients with a fully immunocompetent system achieving a 100% engraftment. So I think that I feel confident about the fact that we can engraft those patients. The main challenge will be avoid graft-versus-host disease in patients in which a pre-existing inflammatory milieu can, of course, impact. Those are patients who have seen in their life a lot of immunosuppressive therapies, a lot of transfusion, who previously failed maybe already a kidney transplant, and so they got exposed to other antigens. So I would anticipate that the risk of having graft-versus-host disease is going to be higher in that population. So that's something to consider. And then on a research basis, it would be very important to understand and dissect so that we can potentially tailor, again, prophylaxis ad hoc to minimize it. But overall, I think that the direction is really to translate this approach to other indications and hopefully in the near future also to other organs like the liver and eventually the intestine, because it is dramatic on how miserable is the quality of life of patients who receive a solid organ transplant. And I think we have the possibility of making these patients independent from lifelong immune suppression. And we made some step forward. So now we need to continue and try to get to the final goal.
Thank you so much, Alice. This is really terrific. And we are all eager to know and see more of your work. I might a little bit biased because, you know, I'm a previous mentee of yours, but I'm sure everybody will agree with me. And today has been amazing hearing from yourself the story of these patients. And thank you so much for giving us an overview of your research work.
Thank you, Carmelo. Thank you. Thank you to the EVMP. It has been a really pleasure to be here, especially with you, and looking forward to the next achievements.
Thank you so much.